Good afternoon, and welcome to today's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Eagle Theater at Los Altos High School. My name is Leslie Saul Garvin. It is my pleasure to introduce Tony DeRose, senior scientist at Pixar Animation Studios. Tony heads the research group responsible for the cutting-edge technology behind Pixar's blockbuster films. He received his undergraduate degree in physics from the University of California, Davis, and his PhD in computer science from the University of California, Berkeley. Before joining Pixar, Tony spent 10 years at the University of Washington as a professor of computer science and engineering. He was a major contributor to the Academy Award-winning animated short film, Jerry's Game, and in 2006, received a Scientific and Technical Achievement Academy Award for his work on surface representations. Please join me in welcoming Tony DeRose.
Well, thank you, Leslie. It's a huge honor to be here today. I've been listening to the Commonwealth Club for a long time, and I didn't tell the organizers this when they invited me, but I don't belong here. As Leslie said, my day job is running the research group at Pixar, and our mission there is to try to develop technology in advance of the needs of future films. There are a lot of innovators at Pixar. We're not the only ones. So we try to distinguish what we work on from what others in the company work on by finding those really risky parts and seeing if we can push them forward. But I'm also a parent and a former educator. And so I've become really interested in ways in which that Pixar or Pixar and Disney together can help to bring some inspiration and relevance to math and science topics, especially to middle and high school kids, which is where a lot of them seem to be turned off. Now, one question might be, you know, why should a company like Pixar care about this topic? And there are a number of reasons, but one is something you might call enlightened self-interest. We plan to be around for a while, and our company, like many others in Silicon Valley and elsewhere, is really dependent on finding the best creative minds and pairing them with the best technical minds to produce, you know, terrific new products. So it's in our best interest to help train those young minds. But it's important to recognize that it isn't sufficient to train students for the way we do things today. We need to train them for technologies that haven't yet been invented. I mean, you know, let's not forget that when I was in middle school, computer graphics didn't even exist, so there was no way I could have been trained for it. So it's really crucial that we try to focus on timeless skills, things like inventiveness, creativity, curiosity, the ability to learn on one's own. And so I've been involved in developing a few initiatives with those goals in mind, and I'd like to tell you about a couple today. The first one, which just explains the math part of the title, Movies, Math, and Making. It turns out my opinion and the opinion of many others, I think, is that one of the ways science and math technology can be improved these days is by making it more relevant to the real world. That is, helping kids and teachers answer the question, when am I ever going to need this stuff? And the other is creativity, and that's really answering the question, and why isn't it going to be boring after 6 months or a year? And so it's those particular characteristics that we're trying to hit on. Now, in terms of relevance, I hope that our movies are relevant and interesting to kids these days. And it is the films are intimately dependent on a huge amount of math and science topics under the hood. And so one of the things I've been doing is going around giving talks to teachers and students to try to pull back the covers and expose the fact that just about any mathematics they can learn through high school, and in fact probably through sophomore college, we use all the time every day at Pixar. I don't have time to do the whole talk, that talk today, but I would like to give you a little bit of a flavor. So let's take a very simple situation where we have maybe a square appearing on the screen, and that square is simply animated across from left to right. Well, simple enough, but if you look at the mathematics underneath, even just the simple example motivates all sorts of things. For instance, coordinate geometry. The fact that we have to do all this inside a computer means that we have to reduce everything to numbers. But what we talk about is geometry on the screen, and so that geometry has to become numerical somehow, and that is great motivation for introducing coordinate systems. So, for instance, an x-coordinate says how far a point is to the right, and a y-coordinate says how far up it is. And then as that square moved across the screen, the x-coordinate was increasing, and so that's a visual description requiring addition. So, to summarize, the mathematics of translation is addition. The mathematics of scaling, it turns out, is multiplication. The coordinates of the object being scaled have those coordinates multiplied by the scaling factor. It turns out the mathematics behind rotation is trigonometry. And we generally put these various transformations, translation, scale, rotation, into a common form that requires matrix algebra. So addition you learn, you know, maybe in first or second grade, multiplication shortly after that, trigonometry and matrix algebra in high school. But all those topics, again, we use all the time every day. We even use the fourth dimension. It turns out that we have to do all our calculations in three dimensions, but because of some of the underlying mathematical structure, it's actually simpler to write all the algorithms and the formulas in four dimensions. So some fairly abstract stuff, but all in service of something very concrete, a final film. Lots of other examples. To create the final imagery you see in the movies requires a simulation of light bouncing around in a virtual environment. So the problem being solved here is virtual objects have been placed in a virtual environment, virtual light sources have been positioned, a virtual camera is placed there, and these are all just software concepts, mathematical concepts. And then we have to simulate how light is going to bounce around in that environment back to the object. And so there are great topics from physics that describe the optics of light. And then to produce the imagery, we need some fairly deep concepts from mathematics, in particular integral calculus, to create the final imagery. Now, hopefully you're not thinking about the fact that we're using calculus when you're watching the film. Hopefully you're caught up in the story and you're worried about Woody going down the garbage chute. But if you step back for a second, it's just incredible how much mathematics we have here. Now, these are examples of mathematics that are fairly old and were developed for other disciplines but have been imported into computer graphics. But it turns out that there are also branches of mathematics that have been developed new and, in fact, been developed because of the movie industry. And one of those branches of mathematics addresses the problem of how you represent the complex shapes that our characters take on. I mean, even something like your hand, if you hold it up and look at it, your hand is a pretty complicated thing. It's not just a sphere or some cylinders. And not only do we have to represent the static geometry, we also have to make it move in fairly complicated ways. And that has required the development of new mathematics. I won't discuss that new mathematics today. The second initiative I'd like to talk about is something we're calling the Young Makers Program. This is a collaboration between the Exploratorium in San Francisco, Pixar, and Make Magazine and Maker Faire. Actually, before I talk about the Young Makers Program, I want to mention one other initiative we're involved in to help get this message about math and science in the movies. We started working with the Museum of Science Boston to create a science exhibit called the Science of Pixar. And it'll first open in Boston and then travel around. So this should be a great way to get some of these stories out into the public and moving around in a much higher leverage way, and we're really excited about that. So the Young Makers Program is designed to help support and nurture the next generation of inventors and scientists and mathematicians through really hands-on projects. There's so much learning these days is moving in a virtual direction, online, simulated, and that's fine. But we want to remind people that the real world is a pretty interesting place too. And there really aren't a lot of support networks in place to address kids that like to make things. The structure of the program and the kinds of projects we work on are partly motivated by my own family's experience. And so let me tell you a little bit about that backstory. I have two sons, Joseph, who's now 13, and Sam, who's now 17. And we all enjoy creativity and making things. And so we've started, over the last few years, kind of a family tradition where we try to pick an engineering challenge for ourselves in time to start work over Christmas break. So we're doing something more than just eating turkey and pumpkin pie. And then we work nights and weekends leading up to an event that's coming soon called Maker Faire in San Mateo. How many of you have been to Maker Faire, know of Maker Faire? Ah, awesome. I've got the right audience. So the fair, for those of you that don't know, is a little bit like a county fair, except instead of exhibiting livestock and vegetables, inventors, tinkerers from around the Bay Area and in fact, all over the place come to share their projects with the public. The range of projects is incredible, everything from green technology to crafts to 15-foot walking giraffes to small egg plotters. There are about 600 exhibitors, typically the last couple of years, and 90,000 to 100,000 attendees. So it's a big deal, and the range of creativity is absolutely phenomenal. So it provides a great stage to exhibit these projects. Well, in 2009, we were brainstorming over dinner, and we had just finished playing with potato cannons, and I imagine a number of you are familiar with potato cannons. They're pieces of PVC pipe, plumbing pipe, that you glue together. You ram a piece of potato down the barrel, and you squirt hairspray in the back end. And when you ignite the hairspray, you can launch a potato about 400 feet, which is really compelling, especially for teenage boys. So we had just finished playing with potato cannons, and one of the boys had just been studying the Civil War, which is when Gatling guns came in. And so we wondered, naturally, could we build a Gatling gun version of a potato cannon? And here's what we came up with. So it can fire all six barrels in well under a second, and it can be pretty impressive. Now, some of you may be sitting there looking at this going, it seems pretty pointless, maybe at first glance, and maybe even at second glance it looks pretty pointless. And hopefully a few of you are sitting out there saying, I want to do that. This project was just really rewarding. You know, none of us, me nor the boys, knew if we could do this thing. So we spent a huge amount of time, you know, discussing all kinds of possible designs and ended up with a project that really naturally integrated all sorts of different disciplines. Mechanical engineering, woodworking, electrical engineering, chemistry, physics, and all these different disciplines came together in a really natural way that the kids were excited about because we were building something that was interesting to them. And then when we got to the fair, I watched as they described the theory of operation and all the geeky little design details to tens of thousands of people that came by the booth. So, as a parent, just step back and just sort of reflect on how much learning had gone on, and how well they were able to articulate what they had done to adults was just it was just super rewarding as a parent. And so that was when I started approaching the folks at Make and Exploratorium, and it turns out they had been thinking similarly about how to bring these kinds of experiences to other kids and other families. And so that was the genesis of the Maker Faire, or the Young Makers Program, which we piloted first in 2010. And the idea is pretty simple. We look for kids that like to build things, and we try to pair them with adult mentors to help them realize their vision in time for the fair. We also have to find fabrication facilities for them, and we're organized currently along community and club-based young makers clubs. We've helped to seed between 50 and 70 of those clubs now. So each club consists of, you know, one or a few young makers that get together as often as they need to complete their projects. And then once a month we meet at the Exploratorium as a regional group where we pull together these days about 150 kids in our last season for an event each month at Exploratorium called Open Make, where they get some hands-on opportunities to do some skills building. They get to share their projects with other young makers as in progress month to month, so everybody gets to watch the progress, and they get to talk about their failures. We embrace failure as a means to success. We don't avoid failure. We try to learn from it and pick up the pieces and go on. And then finally, they get exposed to some really fantastic featured makers that are really accomplished in all sorts of different areas of science, technology, and art. This is a group that participated in the pilot run. There are three girls that previously didn't know each other, but they got together with a mentor and built a reconfigurable hamster habitat that doubles as a coffee table. Yeah. One interesting thing about this program is the project ideas come from the kids themselves, and so you just see a huge range of ideas and disciplines required to pull off what their project vision is. This is called the Water Totter. It was built by a group of 12-year-old girls and their dads working out of a garage. So as you teeter-totter, water is pumped up some bicycle parts, and then there's a fountain that flows down. So it's both an art piece and exercise. Again, this is like 12-year-olds, you know, working with dads came up with the idea for this. It was very successful. In addition to, you know, working out of garages, like the last group, we've also connected with a couple of adventurous young teachers. This is Aaron Vanderwerf, who's a science teacher at the Lighthouse Charter School in Oakland. And his what he did is he took his junior and senior level robotics class and turned it into a young makers club starting last year and is doing it again this year. And this is a team of girls that built a custom electric guitar with LEDs on the frets and the strings to show which chords are being played. So this is an example where technology and music come together, for instance. And I think this sort of, you know, broad, open-ended project program that lets you know, art and science naturally mingle is part of the reason we have about 40% participation from girls. I think another reason is that we're non-competitive. We're based more on an exhibition model than a competition model. So there are no winners and losers. The thrill of building the project comes from within, and students feel gratified when they take it and share it with interested adults. Some of the projects are big, some are small. This is a project that was done as part of a homeschooling group. This is Casey. It's an RC car that's been hacked with a smartphone to serve as a vision system. And the vision system was programmed to follow circles in the visual field. So the amount of technology that went into this thing is incredible. Casey's 15, or was at the time of that project. This is Savannah and her mentor, Sarah. They worked out of the Intel Community Clubhouse in San Rafael. So all sorts of different situations can be great hosts for young makers clubs. Savannah was interested in building a music visualizer. So there are LEDs mounted that display different patterns depending on the frequency content of the music. And that required her to learn the basics of digital signal processing and how to read schematics and how to solder. She also learned how to burn up a few parts and, you know, got that great smell of burning electronics in her nose. But that's okay. You know, you do it again. It's not that expensive. This is Joey. Joey was 14 last year. He's a student in Arizona. His mother found out about the program and the fair and was really excited to bring him. Joey also has Asperger's syndrome and has a difficult time succeeding in most common classroom situations. But his mother tells us that he just really connects to making. He just loves doing this stuff. And since attending the Maker Faire Bay Area last year, I think he's been to every other Maker Faire, Detroit, New York, since then. And he was even invited to the White House. So this is Joey demonstrating his marshmallow cannon for President Obama, and somebody remarked that this is the happiest they've ever seen one of our presidents. There's also a nice story behind the project in that Joey had the vision for building this thing. He went to Home Depot, started shopping around, started asking some fairly strange questions about the parts. One of the customer service folks got interested and ended up being Joey's mentor. These projects can be really wonderful community building experiences. I'd like to close the remarks portion by showing you a little video from the project that my family, along with four other families, are involved in this year. I mentioned Sam earlier, and he tends to be interested more in the electrical and mechanical aspects of projects. My younger son, Joseph, is more the filmmaker, and he takes on the role of documentarian for these projects. So I think this is an example of how many different, skills can all come to bear in a really natural way on these kinds of projects. And so let me just close with this promo video for the project that we're frantically trying to finish for the fair this year.
I'm Sam DeRose. For the past couple years, we've been contributing projects to the Maker Faire, and every year they seem to get more and more elaborate. This year, we're building a flight simulator inspired by the TV show Battlestar Galactica.
So we started out with a couple Lego models for testing. This was the first one we made as like a design prototype. From there, we moved to a more complicated one. This is our motion test bed to make sure that our motors are going to be able to talk with the software and get the motion how we want it. And from there, we moved to a CAD model. This is an Autodesk Inventor model, and we use this as a more accurate design prototype as well as to help us create a bill of materials. And then we actually built it.
Here we strapped in the pilot with a 6-point harness, and we can roll on two axes, this one and this one, and 360 degrees both ways. And we can use these two axes to simulate any flying sensation.
In addition to recreating the feeling of flying, we're also trying to create a totally immersive experience by having joystick, thrusters, instrument panel, 3 computer monitors to display the virtual world, a ton of additional set dressing and blinky lights, and audio and video clips, which we're making ourselves.
So for the audio and visual elements, we are using a variety of programs, such as Final Cut Express, Adobe After Effects, Adobe Photoshop, and GarageBand, to create any video pieces or sound effects needed for the flight experience.
So in addition to all of the hardware, the Viper project also requires a whole lot of software development. Specifically, the actual game that's going to be running on the panels within the cockpit, which is an open source flight simulator called Flight Gear, and also all of the Arduinos that are controlling the internal set dressing and internal controls, so we have to program for all of those, and the glue code in Python that communicates between the game and the controls and the Arduinos.
Young Makers is a volunteer organization. If you'd like to sign up to start a club, to be a mentor, if you have some shop space, please visit youngmakers.org. There's a sign-up list, a sign-up link in the left margin, and we'd love to get you on our mailing list and plugged into the network. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Tony DeRose, great presentation, really, really inspiring. My name is Eric Darnell. I've directed a number of films for DreamWorks Animation, and I'll be the moderator today. Please write any questions on your card at any time, and they can be delivered right up here as we move forward. Before I get into the questions that have come from the audience, I wonder if you could just give us a history of your background and what led you to where you are today.
Sure. I think I'll, like a lot of people from my generation, I was really inspired initially by the space program, by Apollo. And I was born in 1958, so by the time I really became conscious, the country was really consumed with Apollo. And I've always wanted to be a scientist. I think because of that that context. I never knew quite what a scientist was for a long time. I have some early memories of sitting out on the porch trying to make a robot out of a cap gun, right? But that interest has always been there. So I knew I wanted to go to college. I knew I wanted to go to graduate school. I ended up studying physics in college because I found it intellectually so fascinating. And then when I was faced with the decision to go to grad school, I could either go into physics and try to compete with 400 years of the most brilliant people on the planet, or I could go into computer science, which was only about 10 years old at that point. So I thought, well, maybe I can have a bigger impact in computer science. So I jumped ship at that point and studied computer science in grad school. And about the time I showed up, in fact, I think pretty close to the same day I showed up at Berkeley, another new professor, Brian Barsky, showed up. And he was working in this very early discipline called computer graphics at the time. And we hooked up almost immediately and did research for about 10 years at the University of Washington. And for the last 16 years, I've been making cartoons for a living.
So, one of the phrases we have in the cartoon industry is cartoon physics. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about the difference between the physics that you might learn at a university and the Pixar cartoon physics?
Right. So most people that simulate physics come from the engineering disciplines. And, since they're studying, things like, will this airplane really fly and will that car really be safe in a crash, they have to be very careful to match the physics of the real world. At least I hope they do, because I use those products. For the film industry, physics is a starting point. People's intuition about how things move is, governed largely by physics. But we want to go beyond that. We want to be able to tell stories with physics. And so we're much more concerned about developing physical simulations that are plausible but can also be directed. So if the director says, I want that splash to occur 10 frames earlier and go this high, we want to have algorithms and techniques that let us respond to that.
Do you think video games are important in stimulating interest in math, science, and education?
Oh, yeah. If anything, I think video games these days incorporate more technology than we do in film. One reason is that in film, as you know, the director wants to be in control of the audience at every moment, be able to guide their eye, guide their emotions. And so a lot of decisions can be made at the time the film is being created. A video game, on the other hand, is much more dynamic. It's much more interactive. There is no director. There is no human sitting next to the game player going, okay, now make that blow up, move the camera over here. Much more of that all has to be automated. And that automation really comes from technologists and algorithms. So I think video games are an incredibly interesting area for technologists these days.
Is there also an opportunity to use video games as a way, sort of similar to what you're doing with the young makers, to find interesting ways for kids to access math ideas, for example.
Right. So the idea of making really goes beyond, you know, some of the projects I showed. I emphasized the physical, tangible things, but filmmaking is a form of making. Creating video games is a form of making. Creating video games that interact with the real world is sort of an interesting thing. So, and all the basic underpinnings for what's needed to create those games and experiences is freely available on the web these days. For filmmaking, for instance, for computer graphics filmmaking, there's a wonderful open source system called Blender, which is about as fully featured as any of the tools we use in-house. There's Scratch from MIT, which is a programming environment where you can build video game-like experiences using audio and audio clips and imagery. So there's a huge amount of available material out there to get started. Yeah.
In the last 5 or 10 years, what gadget or technological device is your favorite, or perhaps finally cannot live without?
Oh, I'm a bit of an odd duck on this one, I think. My current favorite tool is a bandsaw. They're very versatile, and I held off getting one until last year. So it's one of my newer tools, and so maybe that's one of the reasons it's so attractive.
Well, that was this question. What's the most useful project product you use when doing inventions with your kids? You mentioned lots of math concepts that you use at Pixar. Are there other avenues of science that get applied, to the work that you do?
Oh, I think, every aspect of science gets used one way or another. Examples are we tell stories with creatures that, look like quadrupeds, or quadrupeds that walk on two legs. And understanding the biomechanics of real animals is one way to understand how those characters should move. And again, the biomechanics of real animals is a starting point, and then we branch off from there. So we bring in scientists that know the real world, and we interview them, and then we extrapolate. So,
yeah, we've even had scientists that come and just sit in on our process, or a physicist, in fact, that will give us advice on how characters and things are moving in the films that we do. Is Pixar involved in moving its animation technology into other applications outside of the work you do in-house? Whether it's video games or software that might be available publicly or biomechanics?
Like that. Not that I'm aware. I think Pixar is a film studio, and actually historically Pixar was many different kinds of companies. It started out as a hardware manufacturer, actually. That's where the name Pixar comes from, the Pixar Image Computer. And that image computer was initially designed for the medical imaging world. But Ed Catmull, our president, had always had in mind the ultimate ability to tell stories with computer graphics. So eventually the technology and the algorithms and everything got to the point where we could actually become a film studio, and that's what we plan to—that's what we are now, and what we plan to be.
Could you talk a little bit about the difference between what is called traditional animation and the work that you do at Pixar, and how you take a drawing or an idea that may be very simple and end up with the end product that you have on screen? I know that's a huge question.
One of the versions of the talk I give spends about 15 or 20 minutes talking about the filmmaking process itself. So let me just summarize that in maybe a couple of minutes. So we talk about a filmmaking pipeline consisting of a number of stages. In truth, it's really not a pipeline at all. There's all sorts of feedback all over the place, but let's pretend it's a pipeline for now. So the first stage is really trying to figure out the story, and it's really not a technology problem. That's more of a mindshare problem, you know. So we have great story artists, great storytellers that really try to, you know, find compelling story arcs and worlds to tell those stories in. And then as that process starts to solidify, the art departments start to ramp up and create a lot of concept art that never actually appears in the film, but certainly informs what the film becomes. And it's really a process of discovery. There's, you know, our artists, as I'm sure they are at DreamWorks, feel that there's a great story in there somewhere, and it's their job to uncover it, much like a sculptor, you know, finding the lion inside a hunk of marble. So there's a lot of art to design the characters and the worlds, and then as that art starts to solidify, what we call model packets are created, and those are really the equivalent of blueprints for the models. And so that's when the digital modelers start taking over and creating the geometry, creating the shading, which is what we call how the object is going to respond to light when it's lit by virtual environments. And then the animators take over to breathe life into the characters and create the acting along with the voice talent. And then the simulation department adds cloth and hair and particulate matter. And then the final rendering department and the lighting department are responsible for creating the, you know, beautifully polished pixels that you see in the final image. So some of those stages are reflected in traditional animation, but many of them are brand new disciplines, you know, that have only emerged in the last 20 years or so.
You know, you've spoken a lot about how science informs so much of what you do and Pixar does to make these films. Does it go the other way as well? Are there ways that science and scientists are able? I mean, in a little bit, you're saying a lot of things are developed specifically for the filmmaking, but does that translate back to the world in some way?
Yeah, there's some nice synergy between both the entertainment industry and the science community. You know, as I mentioned, we borrow a ton of science concepts for making the films. And occasionally, new technology is developed in the films that contributes back to science. A couple of examples. One is that, you know, back in the 60s, scientists would do numerical calculations, and they'd get big reams of printouts of numbers to describe what the outcome of the simulation was. And it's very difficult to look at, you know, a stream of numbers and really get any intuition. And so they've been actually instrumental in developing the computer graphics field as a way to visualize their data and their simulations. So that's one place where graphics has contributed back to science. And I mentioned this new mathematics to create the surfaces of our characters. That was invented 20 or 30 years ago. One of the initial ideas was by Ed Catmull, our president. Again, he's an amazing guy. And that's still a vibrant area of mathematical research. So
as a parent, could you share your advice or experience on how you and other parents have helped their kids find and pursue their passions?
Well, I think you hit on it right there, is that kids can be so much more motivated if they're passionate about the thing they're doing. So rather than trying to, you know, count on being able to inspire passion in them in some area, be it music or sports or whatever, another really effective strategy, I think, is to just find out what they're passionate about today and try to leverage that. An example from my own family is my younger son was interested in a particular video game, Metroid Prime. And so the Maker Faire project we did in 2011 was Metroid Prime themed. We built a wearable version of the uniform that the video game character wears. And so because that leveraged his interest in that particular video game, it was also a great way to, you know, get him to learn you know, how to read electrical schematics and how to solder and all sorts of things.
Do you have a favorite video game?
I'm not really a gamer. I think I came too late for that.
So I think you've touched on this a little bit, but for folks who are interested in getting into you know, your industry, are there ways that you can be a part of it without a lot of mathematics behind you?
Yeah, there are several different populations that we have at Pixar, and other film studios are similar. We have a lot of our employees are trained in the traditional arts. They get, you know, degrees in the fine arts. They learn animation at places like CalArts, and they're fundamentally artists. They know enough technology to use the tools. But then we have the technology side of the house, which are they're fundamentally technologists, and but they have a sensitivity to working with artists in the same way that the artists have a sensitivity to working with other talented people in other disciplines. And then we have finance and marketing and all sorts of other opportunities as well. So it's there's a big mix that goes into making a film. We like to say it's filmmaking is a big team sport. You know, it takes 100, 200 people to make a film.
For the kind of stuff that you're doing at Pixar now, a lot of it's research-based work. You were also doing that in an academic setting before Pixar. Could you talk a little bit about the differences that you find in working in those two different environments, those two different research environments?
Yeah, they're both environments, both industry and academics, are really interesting and really complementary. I think it's really great that we have both. In academics, there's much more emphasis on what you might call curiosity-based research. The professor gets interested in some particular topic and has the freedom to pursue it. In industry, we're a bit more goal-oriented. So there are particular problems that we see around the studio that, you know, we clearly have to figure out how to solve. We also try to leave ourselves open for those, you know, moments of inspiration, you know, that typically occur in the shower, where you just have, you know, a really, you know, potentially great idea just completely outside the box. So we try to leave, you know, some room for that even in industry to pursue. One of the challenges in being in academics is something that people refer to as technology transfer. So you've got a great idea in the lab. How do you get people out in the real world to actually use it? And I experienced this frustration myself. I had three different technologies that I had developed in the lab that I thought would be useful in the film industry and in engineering design, and nobody was listening. So one of the reasons I went to Pixar is to do that technology transfer first person. And one of the technologies immediately stuck. Another one is just now starting to be used. And the third one turned out to be irrelevant.
You know, things are moving and changing so quickly, you know, especially in technology these days. And it seems like, you know, you almost have to be a practicing futurist to know, you know, what you're working on today is going to be valid and valuable, you know, 6 years from now when it's going to be ready to be used. I mean, how do you approach that, and how do you, you know, try to, you know, accommodate for the speed at which things are changing?
It's hard, and it's not a science. One of the things we try to do is hire researchers that have proven good at that kind of judgment, you know, looking at the trends today, being able to extrapolate forward, and, you know, hopefully, you know, having the vision to go beyond where we are today. But that's one of the things that graduate school in particular helps you with. Writing a PhD dissertation, for instance, that's your job, you know, figure out something that hasn't been done before that may be useful in the future, and work with your professor to make it happen.
Do you think the days of the mouse and keyboard are numbered?
Oh, I hope so. One of the areas that a couple of students and collaborators and I have been working on for the last several years is to understand what the ideal movie-making workstation might be. You know, the idea being that maybe it's maybe we can do better than a mouse and a keyboard for making movies. And so we've been looking at a variety of technologies. In fact, our first Maker Faire project in 2008 was a 2-foot by 3-foot multi-touch display. In today's terms, you could think of it as a giant iPad, but in 2008, no such thing existed, of course, and you couldn't buy anything commercially. So we built one in the garage and took it to Maker Faire and had a great time with that, and then brought it back to the lab, and it supported research that we did for another couple of years there.
Do you have a favorite Pixar movie?
Oh. Some people feel that that's akin to asking, do you have a favorite child? But I like The Incredibles.
Are there any, you know, mathematical concepts you can talk about? You talked a little bit about the hand, but how you deal with getting those characters to move around and getting that them to feel like flesh and to muscles and all that stuff underneath the skin, all that organic goo that can be so difficult to, you know, feel real and natural.
Right. You just hit on the hardest aspect of building a character. I mentioned earlier I had some technology that I brought to Pixar and it turned out to be irrelevant. Well, that technology was designed to quickly capture the shape of things. So you could take a sculpt, for instance, and it was based on laser scanning technology at the time. So that's the geometry creation. Then, as you mentioned, there's this process of instrumenting that geometry so that it moves in all the right ways. And so you get that, you know, nice bulgy muscle under skin feel. And it turns out that the motion is far more complicated than the geometry itself. So even if you look at the time to build a character, the time to create the geometry is just a tiny fraction, and all the rest is spent trying to get it to move properly. So even if the technology I brought in would make that tiny fraction go away, it just doesn't make any difference in the overall time and effort to build a character. And we have incredibly talented technical artists, really, that are responsible for building that. We call it rigging. Building that rigging so that the character moves in all the ways that the animator and the director are going to need to tell the story appropriately. And they bring together many of the skills of a Swiss watchmaker. There's all sorts of machinery, mathematical machinery that goes into constructing a character, and they're the ones crafting that machine.
You know, it seems like some of the most difficult things to do in computer graphics and animation are the things that we experience every day, and that even a young child can call out, you know, fake clouds or fake water. How do you deal with that? The complexities of those systems and getting them to feel right and natural on screen.
Well, there's typically a lot of iteration involved. So we'll start with an initial guess at how we think something should look or should move, and then we show it around and we get notes. And, oh, okay, yeah, you're right. It doesn't quite respond correctly to the shadowing through the cloud. Okay, so let's go figure out how to make the shadowing work. And we just keep doing that and doing that until we hit a level of believability that is, furthers the story.
How many researchers are there in the group that you're a part of?
We have about 7 or 8 full-time researchers right now, and then we also have postdoctoral students and interns. So we'll swell to 20, 25 people during the summer and then drop back down to about 10 or 11 during the year.
And are there internships for, you know, all the different departments and areas of specialty at Pixar?
Yeah, we have a really active intern program all across the company, not just in the technology areas, but also in art and animation. And we try to keep our company website, pixar.com, up to date with all the latest postings.
Is it primarily for, say, college students, or are there opportunities for younger kids as well and young adults?
Yeah, the current program is designed for students 18 and older. So,
I see. Well, how many hours have you and your son spent on that flight simulator?
We did a rough cast. So there are five young makers, four kind of hardcore mentors, and then a variety of consultants and other parents helping out. But we did a rough calculation and determined that we're going to end up with about a man-year's worth of effort, which actually isn't bad at all for building a flight simulator.
I think at one point I calculated how many man-years it took to make one of these feature films, and I think if you were working out by yourself, you'd have to get started in about 1200 AD.
Yeah.
A lot of effort, a lot of hours go into these movies. So could you talk a little bit more for those budding Gatling gun enthusiasts out there, how that gun works and how it's different than the simple hairspray gun that you talked about initially?
Oh, I could talk for hours about these projects, as can the kids. So the major difference is we needed a way to spin the barrels. So we needed some mechanical mechanism for spinning. And then we also needed some automatic way for the gun to fire when it reached the top of its arc. And so rather than just, you know, sticking a barbecue lighter up the back end and clicking it a few times as you would a normal potato can, we had to have something that was fairly robust and automatic. And we worked on probably a dozen different possible designs. And that was a really great opportunity to for the kids to see the process of design. It's typically iterative. There are problems with every design, but you try to, you know, do something quickly, understand what's good about it and bad about it. And the final design came late one night, not long before the fair. Sam and I were, you know, standing out in the garage in our pajamas, you know, staring at a sketch pad. And we sort of had an idea that seemed interesting. And then we both stopped and we just looked at each other and smiled. And we had come to exactly the same realization and exactly the same time. And, you know, as a researcher, I get paid to invent things, but that moment of discovery was one of the most satisfying I've ever had. And it was because, it was my son.
It's nice to be able to have an epiphany and share it, you know, yeah, with someone that's close to you. Absolutely. So as future Pixar employees are winding their way through the educational system, what would be your recommendation if they're, say, specializing in digital and media arts, but feel that they'd also like to augment their education with science? Would you double major? Are there ways to integrate those two, you know, seemingly perhaps very isolated different disciplines in the academic setting?
Well, I think my major advice would be, you know, again, figure out what you're passionate about and become really great at it, and then broaden, you know, find the other connections, but always working from that place of passion. If you try to kind of artificially bolt two things together, it's going to feel artificial. And I'm, you know, maybe naive, but I've seen it happen enough that when people really follow their passion and really become great about something, they can make it happen. So that's the primary advice. The discipline is changing so fast that I think the some of the general skills that everybody should be interested in is, you know, how do you learn on your own? You know, how do you use the web? How do you use your network of friends? How do you find your way? And those are really skills that I think will, you know, serve everybody for as long into the future as we can see. You know, middle schoolers these days are going to be retiring in the year 2060. We have no clue what the world is going to look like then.
So, controlled by robots.
Perhaps. Especially if Ray Kurzweil is right, we'll all be robots ourselves. So.
Exactly. Of course, that's a lot of what he does, too, is try to look to the future, even for his practical, you know, speech recognition software and stuff that he's always got to be ready for. What about 3D films now? That's all the rage. Are you a fan?
Oh, am I a fan of 3D? I wouldn't say that I'm predisposed to 3D, but I have seen a lot of use of the technology lately in really creative ways that contribute to the experience rather than being a gimmick. I think one of the first pieces I saw was there's a U2 concert film that was done in 3D, and there are some shots in there that are creatively, I think, brilliant. They use 3D in a way that really increases your sense of presence. You feel like you're on stage with the band, and those are the kinds of uses of 3D I think that are really compelling.
Yeah, that was an incredible film, and what I also liked about it is how sometimes they'd have multiple 3D points of view. You know, you'd see Bono up close, and then you'd see the distant on screen left, and then the stage on screen right in the distance, and you could sort of just wander through the space with your eyes.
And that was the first time I had really seen. I think you're pointing to that. You know, new visual metaphors with this new capability, and I just can't wait to see what some of the young filmmakers are going to do with 3D to get very non-physical effects, multiple planes in which the imagery is in focus, which you can't get with a physical camera, or at least a traditional camera.
Right.
It's a new tool, but I think it's going to take us a while to really learn how to use it to its creative potential.
A lot of people complain of eye strain and headaches when they see a 3D film, but there's ways to get around that, I suspect.
I'm certainly not an expert in this area, but there are psychophysicists, for instance, working in university labs that are trying to understand when 3D hurts the viewer and when it contributes. And then, so there's starting to be, a list of do's and don'ts. And you know this far better than I do, directing a 3D film. But I think we're starting to learn more. I think there's still more to learn.
So you won a 2006 Technical Award for Surface Representations. Was it, is that the Academy Award that you... Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit more about what that award was for?
Sure. It was for developing some of the mathematics behind the representation of shape I alluded to earlier. And the basic idea is actually pretty simple. So we need to create shapes that are smooth and move in smooth ways. And one way you can do that is imagine taking... drawing a square on a piece of paper and then cutting some corners off that square to turn it into maybe an octagon. And so now you've doubled the number of points and the shape is a little bit smoother. And now cut the corners off the octagon to now end up with a 16-sided shape. And now do that infinitely, which would take you quite a while on a piece of paper and pencil. But in a computer, you can do it a large number of times, and in mathematics, you can do it conceptually an infinite number of times. And so this process of cutting off corners we call subdivision, and that turns out to be the best way we know of to create these shapes. And working out some of the mathematics of subdivision, when you get smooth shapes and when you don't get smooth shapes, what kinds of corner cutting works, what kinds of corner cutting doesn't work, and using that in film is what I got the award for, along with two other people, Ed Catmull and a fellow named Jost Stamm. So we had all worked on various aspects of the theory and the practice.
So from your days of teaching and also your interaction with what I'm sure is an international group of folks at Pixar, certainly DreamWorks has people, specialists from all over the world. Do you notice, can you tell that there's a difference in the way science is being taught in schools and universities here versus internationally?
Oh, that's a great question. One difference I've noticed is, especially between the United States and Europe, the Europeans we've tended to hire come in with much more mathematical understanding and underpinning. A lot of the U.S. students we get are, you know, maybe more versed in computer science, but maybe not so comfortable with mathematics. So that's one of the big differences I've seen. Yeah.
So we've got time for one more question. Is there any more advice you could give to parents or students, kids out there that want to get into animation? Is there a particular software they should be looking for, or a particular computer they should be buying, or what's the best way to move forward for them?
Practice. So, if you're interested in animated filmmaking, you mentioned Blender, which is I think you get from Blender.org, and make films, post them to YouTube. There's whole subcultures in YouTube that are interested in Lego filmmaking or filmmaking with graphics. So there's a real audience out there for that. There are also some pretty interesting training opportunities. There's an organization called Animation Mentor that you can find if you Google Animation Mentor. Just practice. You're never too young to start. One of the things I find really wonderful about this day and age is it's a magical moment for creativity in all its forms. It's so much easier to get involved in things today than it was when I was a kid. We had Heath kits, for instance, which you'd find in the catalog and you'd order and maybe it would get there 8 weeks later. And now you can find anything you want and it's on your doorstep in 2 days. So it's great. So just get out and do it. Don't let anybody tell you you can't.
That's right. You can't be a brain surgeon without permission, but you can be a filmmaker right now.
Indeed.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed today's program brought to you by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley. Again, we'd like to thank Tony DeRose, Senior Scientist and Research Group Leader at Pixar Animation Studios, Eric Darnell, Director of Madagascar 3, Europe's Most Wanted, our audience here in Los Altos, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Thank you.